Welcome to Let's Run by Anusha and Friends. Here we're going to talk about anything and everything, and we're going to bring in our opinions, perspectives, and experiences. These are not meant to be 360-degree explainer articles. We hope you'll have a bit of a laugh and maybe a little bit of a think. Hi there, welcome to the fourth episode of Let's Rant. Today I'm joined by special guests Janvi, as usual, and Maya, who's joining us for the first time today. We're going to talk about cultural identity, ethnicity, who we are, who we think we are, and more. So I'm excited for this, and I hope you are too. I'm going to pass it on to our guest Maya to introduce herself.
Hiya.
I'm Maya.
And a part of this is that my name also, it's spelt like Mia, so that's a part of my identity, having to fight and defend my name since birth, since I had to learn how to spell it, and everyone told me I was wrong. But it's a part of life, you learn how to defend yourself, and giving a child a strange name is a good way to build self-awareness and character at a young age. And that's what I've been doing for 20-odd years of my life.
Why didn't you just change the spelling?
That's a lot of work, and I only have 3 letters right now. That this is actually a really good amount. You don't have to stress about lots of syllables, because I struggle with that. So this is a good niche for me. I'll stick at 3.
I'm jealous, you know. There's a H in my name, and people either see the H and call me Janvi, or they...
Janvi.
Yeah, they think it's like a YH. Like
Jesus.
Yeah.
Janvi.
So they... I've had that. Like, school teachers, new teachers, where they see my name on the registers, will just see the letters and put it together. For like a year, all the boys in my class call me Janavi, because one of the teachers said that by accident. I've had Javini, Jahanvi, Janvi. Yeah. It's a mix, so I'll understand your choice to stick with the simplest possible spell. At least they'll spell it right if they won't pronounce it right.
Yeah, and you know, one day when I'm older and on my end of life, I'll try to make a joke to whoever is around me and tell them, ha, my name is actually Mia. I'm trying to
make it's the double bluff.
Just fool them for as long as I can and then bluff again. They'll never know. My parents just like Miami, that's all. And that's why I got Maya like Miami.
That's really cool. That's a rare.
It took me years to figure that out. They never told me.
Have you been to Miami?
Yeah.
What do you
Second
think?
Home. It's too hot, it has too many iguanas. I'm stressed out. But it's also my second home, so yeah.
It's very cool.
Yeah, when I was younger and we were going through the digestive system, realized that the part of the digestive system at the end is called the anus. And for a couple of years, I wouldn't say bullied, but teased is a nice way of saying it. So they would draw the digestive system and they'd be like anus, and someone would go up there and write H and A and be like anus ha. Like Anusha, which is the same spelling as anus ha. So anus ha was my name for a couple of years. So it's not culturally significant or spelling. But I am tempted when people ask me what my name is to be like, Anusha, spelled like anus ha? I need to correct myself and be like, don't tell that. You're an adult now. You can't say anus ha. So that's my cultural identity. But names are fun. I think I always like names that have like a story or a meaning rather than just like random ass names. Anyway, so moving on to today's topic of the day, cultural identity. We started this discussion because cultural identity is quite important, but it's also something I believe that you define for yourself. It's not what your parents define for you or your friends or your spouse or your country of birth, the country you're living in. It's something I think you get to decide for yourself. But that doesn't mean that I allow cultural appropriation. So let's be clear on the lines here. Like, you can't just change your race like a lot of people. <You know? laughs> Like, what I'm saying is not, hey, if you're a fan of one race, change now. That's not what I'm saying. Okay? But I think it's something you do get to define for yourself within appropriate boundaries. And I always considered myself a South Indian, and I'm very proud of my heritage. And then I think a year ago, did a DNA test. And the DNA test actually showed that a majority of my DNA was from what is currently the north of India, but also a little higher than that. So around slightly Kazakhstan, Pakistan, like, so it's more like towards the north than the Middle East in that area. And I was shook. I was like, excuse me, what is this? And then I spoke to my grandfather and he basically said the DNA test is bullshit, which is as much as you can expect a grandfather to say. It just got me thinking on like, is our identity, cultural identity, based on who our ancestors were, where they came from? Is it who we are today? Is it what I'm eating at home? Is it what I'm watching on TV? If it is what I'm watching on TV, then am I American? Despite never having stepped foot in America. So in this mixed up world where I eat food from all different places of the world. Well, not all, from a few. I would say I'm partial to Italian and Mexican food. And of course, Indian food. I watch mostly American and British TV and of course Indian film as well. I work in London. I have friends from all ethnicities. So who am I now? And if I talk to my mother when she was 25 years old, she would say, oh, I'm Indian. Every part of me is Indian. So I think in this world of multiculturalism, trying to understand who we are, where we come from, and what defines us is a fun question, which we want to ponder on today. So with such a loaded question and almost no advance, I'm going to pass it over to Maya to talk about her identity and who she thinks she is, where she thinks she's from, and who she is.
I'll have you know that there was a very intense game of rock, paper, scissors before this decision was made.
And I won, which is why Maya's going
there
first.
There was an unfair advantage. There was a pause and I didn't anticipate that. But alas, I will continue. So I'm Jamaican. I'm proud to be a Jamaican. And for the longest time, I thought Jamaica was, you know, bigger than it actually is, because we have a huge cultural identity on the global stage. Like, I just watched a Bob Marley film yesterday, and I realized we have a huge footprint on the world and how it influenced certain things pop culturally. So I always had an inflated, like, national ego in terms of that, and I acknowledge it. But then sometimes I look at my, you know, under 3 million population and realize it's really tiny. But I do identify as a Jamaican, mainly because I'm a wider Caribbean person, so somebody from the Antilles, just because for us, our history shapes a lot of who we are, not just your ethnicity or like background in that sense, because they have a large melting pot in the region. So for me, my background, I identify as Black and mixed with South Indian and mixed with Latin American and mixed with Scottish as well. So it's a huge mix going on there. But also I was raised in a culture that appreciate the mixture. So we have different like portions of each. Like you will go and get curry goat anywhere in Jamaica. You can't have any huge ceremony of your life without there being curries and roti at present. It's odd. Persons will wonder what happened to you if you don't have it. And then also there's a huge African diaspora presence as well in terms of like our drumming, our musicality as well. So everyone appreciates the sense of Jamaica means you have a little bit of everything mixed up, even if you personally may not have a mix in your family lineage. Culturally, we identify with different sections. So there's just a lot going on. So after a certain while, we just say, I'm Jamaican, please don't question me. It's just a Jamaican thing. We do what we do. I don't know how to explain it. We are who we are. But yeah, I like that. And coming to the UK also showed me how persons view Jamaicans, because I just view home as home. This is my people. This is what we do and it's normal. Then I came here just like, oh wow, I am different than other sections of the world who might have like a similar mix or a similar background. So I come to embrace my Jamaicanness, my very small country. But I mean, we have vibes. So I take the social part of being Jamaican more in terms of the social and cultural influence, whether it be the vibes, the music, how we eat, and I carry that with me everywhere I go.
I actually had no clue Jamaica had such a small population.
Oh yeah, we're tiny.
Like, I don't think I ever thought about it.
And we're one of the big islands. But we are the biggest English-speaking one.
Well, I think you're true. Like, I feel like I've heard of, not very educated on this, but I've heard of Jamaican culture.
I just thought everyone. You were going to say I'm not very educated.
I mean, depending on who you ask, that could be true. On paper, yes, I am very educated. But yeah, that's very cool. I don't think I've met a Jamaican person before.
Oh, really?
No.
I'm here first?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I
I feel honored.
Well, you've been a great experience.
I represent my country well.
Yeah. But my experience is different. I would say, to an extent, it's much more boring than both of you. I feel like it's very common. I'm a British Indian. I was born here, brought up here, but my parents are Indian. They moved here right before I was born from the Midlands, which is a very strong part of my identity, actually. I have a very big complex about it since coming down to London for university. I've been told the Midlands don't exist. You're not from London. You're from north of here, so you're northern. And I have nothing against northern people. I think they're much more friendly than Londoners, but I'm not one of them. And I just remember the first night of university having a screaming match with this guy who was trying to convince me I was northern. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'll show you on a map. It's called the Midlands.
Out of curiosity, where was that guy from?
He was British.
London.
London?
I think London. Oh. He was from Reading. Actually, he was a friend of a friend. He was from Reading. I think he was ethnically East Asian, is all I would say. I remember his name, but we didn't get into his details. I just knew he was from down here somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh. In terms of my wider cultural identity beyond the Midlands, I would say that I am a British Indian, so obviously I identify very strong with my family, and I was brought up connected to my Indian heritage. That sounds like a very weird sentence to say in that matter, but what I mean is that all my extended family is still in India. So it's my parents, I've got a younger brother, and then we go back and we visit them every year, so I'm very connected in that sense. I speak my native language, all of that, and I would have just been like, oh yeah, I'm British Indian, I'm an Indian, woo, let's go. But the most common language in India is Hindi, depending on who you ask. It's not the national language. Basically, Hindi is very widely spoken, especially in North India, not so much in South India, but everyone's taught Hindi. As someone who grew up in the UK, I don't know Hindi. I've never been bothered. It's never affected me. I watch Bollywood movies with the subtitles on.
Me too.
Yeah. After coming to university, so I'm from Kerala, which is in South India, and people from Kerala are called Malayalis. And all my parents' friends are Malayalis as well. And where I grew up, my parents worked, is a very brown area, but also like they're friends with people who are similar to them. So all their friends were South Indians and Malayalis for the most part. And like I had other friends, but like where I went to school was a very, very white area. So I wasn't exposed to other Indians to a large extent, but I knew they were there, but I just didn't interact with them much. But coming to London, there's a lot of brown people in London. I remember going to this like India Society event, and then all these people were standing in a circle and talking in Hindi. And I was just like smiling and nodding. Yeah, I understand. Huh. Yeah. And then someone asked me a question directly and I was like, no Hindi here. Even today, I got my haircut in. And it was by these two Indian ladies who worked in the salon. And they were talking to each other in Hindi. And there's a lady who was cutting my hair, realized I didn't speak Hindi and speaking to me in English. I heard the other lady ask her like, oh, she doesn't understand Hindi, does she? And she's like, a little bit. Because that's what I told them. I was just like, this is an assumption. When you're brown in the UK, in certain areas that you do speak Hindi. I very much started feeling like I identify more as a Malayali than as an Indian. Not because of anyone intentionally doing anything, but it's just like, oh, I don't fit into that. Like, I don't speak Hindi, I don't know these things. I didn't know what Vadapav was until I went to university. Do you know what Vadapav is?
I had to learn as well. Like, I didn't, because we don't have it back home. Like, even in the Indian subcultures back home, like, you have the ethnic groups who, like, still keep on a lot of the cultural traditions, but a lot of them didn't carry over. So I grew up without knowing about certain things. I came here, I'm just like, oh, and now I see what my great grandpa was trying to allude to. I didn't know. He didn't have the words. I didn't have the words. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I kind of learned that too. I don't fit any mold.
I remember I went home and I was like, I asked my mom, because she's definitely Indian. She's not a coconut. My dad is the first person in my life to call me a coconut, by the way. I took it to heart. But anyway, I went home and I was like, Amma, do you know what Vadapav is? And she was like, no. So I was like, okay, it's not me. Malayalis don't know what Vadapav is. That's not on me.
Or it's your parents.
Well, either way, I took it as proof that it's not my fault.
I mean, you don't have to know everything. To be fair, continents like Asia, Africa and Latin America, everybody assumes they're like, oh, Hindi, Spanish, Swahili, and they have these assumptions of like one language and one homogeneous people all cooking strong smelly food and wearing colorful clothes. Like, that's what people think in like natural surroundings, but there's so much of nuance there, because each, like, there's continent, then there's country, then there's state, then there's city. And at every level, there are different languages, there are different religions, there are different clothes, there are different cultures. And culture and religion sometimes intersects, sometimes it doesn't, right? So everything changes. So just because somebody has the same skin color as I do, does not, I mean, there's a good chance we may have something in common, but there's a good chance we also don't. right? Well, I was reading this thing about how they're like, oh, white isn't a culture. And I actually disagree with those kind of statements because, like, if you look at Europe on a whole, there are so many different cultural identities. You have to go to Germany, France. I mean, I'm only citing ones that I've been to. And you can see, like, they have their own food, they have their own clothing, and they have their own traditions. So in general, I feel like trying to group one set of people into one bucket, and like brown, black, white, I don't think that does justice to anything beyond what they look like. And even then, it's not really accurate. Like, if I had to match my skin tone to something, I don't know what the hell shade that would be. So, yeah.
Do you have that problem too? Like, when you're in primary school and you had to, like, shade and draw people, I'm like, what do I use? Yellow, dark brown, black, and see what I could mix. And I tried to mix the pencil crayons together, and I'm like, this doesn't look like a human. Because the colors, they just didn't have, like, a wide array until somebody came with the 54-pack crayon. That had every color. I didn't even understand some of these colors. And that's when I found my actual shade. I'm like, wow, I exist in a 54-pack Crayola crayon.
You know, actually, somebody sued a company because I don't know which crayon company it was, but they had skin color and they had, like, somewhere, I would say, it was more between pink and white. It was within that coral shade. So they sued them because they said this isn't, like, representative. And it was a couple of years ago. And they actually won that court case. So that's why you have more colors now, whether it's in crayons or whether it's in makeup.
Yeah.
Thank you, if you ever listen to this podcast.
This reminds me of, like, this was a long time ago, well before, like, Fenty Beauty and, like, all the more diverse range of foundation shades came out. I remember I went on a school trip and me and my friends were at the airport. And I went to a very white school, just by nature of the area it was in. And I was there with all my white friends. I was like, guys, is this my shade? I just picked up the randomest foundation shade, and it was tan foundation, which in 2014 just meant orange. So they were very nice, and we all went on a mission to find my foundation shade. It was just varying shades of orange, but yeah, thank you to the world for becoming more inclusive.
Well, that's what Donald Trump wears. So if it's good enough for a president of the United States, not kidding, it's not good enough.
He's not wearing it well sometimes. No. Too sometimes. Oof.
I'm not sure if it's foundation or just, like, Cheeto dust.
Yeah, but see, here's the funny thing, right? So when I go to a store in India, I see a range of ads that say whitening cream. And then when I go to a pharmacy drugstore equivalent here, I see a range that says tanning salon, tanning kits, tanning sprays. And I'm like, what the heck is going on?
Sometimes I have to do a full-on double take. I'm seeing somebody pass by, I'm just like, my brain isn't calculating because it's winter, it's cold, but you have a very strong tan, but your ankles do not. And I have to, like, double take and look back and, like, what happened? And I'm like, oh.
So I was on the tube one day, and everybody observes people on the tube, okay? Let's not pretend we don't. We all do it. And I was doing that. And then I saw this black lady, and she was wearing a very nice clothes. So I was just, like, looking at her. And then I looked at her eyes, and then there was something wrong, and her eyes were like a shade of blue, but it was natural blue. And I was like, interesting. Then I was looking at her a little deeper, but then I looked down and her hands were white.
That's and what happened then, to me.
And then I realized that who I thought was a black woman was actually a Caucasian woman.
This keeps happening. The Rachel Dozels, they keep on appearing and I get confused. I'm looking for solidarity in this big city and I look around, I see somebody, I'm like, I got bamboozled. because of my mixture and whatever in the sun, I roast. But now in winter, I'm very pale. So I'm changing color and I'm looking, I'm like, wow, what's happened to me?
Who am I?
Foundations don't match. You have one for each, like, season of the year, or else you're not going to make it out looking normal. And you have to check yourself in the mirror exactly, like, did I use the right one? They're matching properly today. I'm now summer warm or springtime. I don't know. But yeah, that happens all the time now.
Yeah, so, like, I know that people have a right to, like, decorate themselves and, like, your body, your choice. But sometimes I have mixed opinions, which are not completely resolved yet. Like, I'm still thinking about it. So if you have any thoughts, you can DM someone. Maybe DM a producer, not me. On whether it's okay to tan yourself or lighten yourself so much that you look like a different race.
It should be like a hair color, you know, like you're not allowed to go from like black hair to blonde in like one sitting. It should be like you've got a limit. You can go two shades lighter or two shades darker in one sitting. Sit like that for 6 months and then we'll see. You know, your skin shouldn't let you do that. It's not good for you.
We do have like a huge bleaching problem back home though, because of like stereotypes and the plantation society we were, you know, developed as a little colony there in Jamaica. So closer to white, more status and privilege, closer to dark, well, back to the fields, basically. So that still holds true today in terms of up until the early 2000s, I would say late 90s, persons who worked as bank tellers, they had to pass like a paper bag test. They would not have darker skin persons at the front of a bag, air hostesses, unless you're like a stunning supermodel. That's the only way you'd see a person darker. Otherwise, no. And then if you can pass the colors test, okay, what about the hair test? You can't have curly hair. So my hair is curly right now for reference. But if I wanted to work like front of house back in the early 2000s, 90s, I had to relax that, make sure it's pinned straight. Or else they're like, oh no, you're not making your hair look, you know, proper. You're looking unbecoming. Even in high school, I couldn't wear my hair out all the time because they'll police that sometimes and say, oh, you really should go and do your hair. You can't have it out in an afro like that. It's distracting. Relax it, braid it, something, but get it under control, basically. As opposed to now, which a lot more persons have freedom, thank God, to like have their hair out and it's more acceptable and more normalized. But in recent history, as in within my, you know, couple years of being on this earth, still paper bag tests within our own society. Like I never grew up with certain like colors at front of house until much recently, like late teenage years. And I'm not 30 yet for reference. I'm not 30. So yeah, that is very much a problem back home, bleaching. So we have the Fair and Lovely or Nadinola cream. Yeah, that cream is like everywhere. Everyone uses it. Well, not let me say everyone, but a lot of persons use it in the form of like social stepping stone to see if they can do it. Especially persons who don't have much educational capital in terms of finding another way to climb the social ladder. So they'll get extreme. They'll be wrapping it with plastic wrap, putting on like deep chemicals, the same one you use to perm your hair. They're like, yeah, if you just let it soak for a little bit, you can get lighter in like 2 weeks, not four. There's a whole science to it now. But yeah, it's a big business back home. A big business. Do you guys have that too?
Yeah. So some of it is attributed to colonialism because it was the richer people in society and town would be the white people who somehow magically owned all the lands, which and then they brought all the other miscellaneous magically owned the lands and they had magic pieces of paper, that's it, to prove it. And they brought people from all over the world into, and they mixed people around, right? Like huge proportions of people from current day South Asia went into Africa and went into the Caribbean, so you still have population. So that's what Maya's describing. So basically the logic was, in the colonial context, it was because they would own it, and labor would be darker in general because labor comes from like modern day South Asia, about like Southeast Asia, as well as Africa and Latin America, but also because people who work in the fields will naturally be darker than people who sit at home. But I recently went to an exhibition on the cult of beauty at the Wellcome Collection. And in there, I discovered that the attribute for fairness and white skin, it doesn't come entirely from there. It's also come from the landlord-peasant relationship. So there were whitening creams in China way before, like hundreds of years ago, before Europeans reached China. And these whitening creams were made of pearl. And that cream existed completely outside European colonization, and it existed because the landlords would be much fairer and the peasants would be much darker. So there's like landlord-peasant social economic relations going on, but also the colonial influence. So it depends on like place to place as well. But what's happened here is now if you're richer, that means you can afford to go to a tropical country, have a tan, have a vacation. So now if you're tan, it means you're richer. So how the tables turn, you know?
Yeah. I think it depends. I'm not talking about your colonialism at that point. But I knew it was a big thing in East Asia as well. The lightning creams and like looking white is the best. It seems to be the same across most of the developing or like the non-white population. That seems to be the aspiration. But I didn't know that it was to do with the landlord peasant. But in the UK or in the Western world, the idea of being tan, partly people just don't want to look pale, but I never thought about it from the holiday angle before, but it's just like they want to seem, you know, sun-kissed and beautiful. That's their ideal of beauty. So is that like an ideal shade of like orange or like tan in between that everyone would be happy with? Like,
they call it olive complexion, because in my mind, people keep on like telling me, oh, this is olive complexion. I'm like, I've seen olives, they're gray and they're black. I've never seen an olive like this.
Okay.
You have, like, if you actually look like olive oil, you have some disease. Like, I'm not kidding.
What is going on with that?
I think basically some writers take a lot of creative liberties while writing, and they mean to say like a Spanish
Mediterranean
vibe, but yeah, they just say olive because that's what they associate. Now, but like olive skin isn't a thing.
Have you guys seen that graph that's like, what do people use across Europe? Like, what?
The
butter is at the top. It's like the UK, Scandinavia, and all of that, and like down south with like Italy and Spain, and like Greece, it's olive oil.
That's so they're the pretty healthier ones. Yeah.
it maps out. It definitely does.
But I don't like olives. Sorry, I'm just gonna put it out
like
there.
I've learned to like them since coming here because it's just cheaper than the food from home. So I gotta start liking some of the food here because I can't afford to be importing. So I'm gonna like olives now.
So, no, I think there's two levels of importing. And this is not commonly known, but a good percentage of the fruits and vegetables that we get in the UK are not grown in the UK. They're all grown and imported. So there's levels of importing. So if you go to a normal supermarket or a store, you will get imported food. It's just not going to be of high quality. The more expensive the food is, the higher quality of imports there are. So technically, we can all import food because of how broken the food system is.
Yeah.
It's because the pound is so much stronger than all the other currencies, especially in Latin America, Asia, Africa, but also even countries like Spain. What happens is that food, the best produce from those countries gets taken when it's not fully ripe yet, or it gets artificially ripened through like chemicals and injections. And then it sits in a shipping container for weeks, and then it reaches the store where we buy from. So imported, buying something imported, almost all of us buy things imported on a daily basis. It's actually cheaper to buy imported fruit of a lower quality than to buy actual British fruit and vegetable. So a lot of the food that you eat is imported, you just don't know it, but it's probably not the highest quality of imported yummy fruit because it sat on a ship for weeks.
Yeah, for like cost-wise, just like make sure it's in bulk, make sure it can take its slow time to get here instead of a fast ship route. Yeah. We still import a lot of food into Jamaica. We don't produce everything, so like fruits and veg we can do, but like anything else, boy, we gotta import that. We have to import that. Wheat, don't know that. That has to come here. So again, it's a lot of fluctuation and seeing like what the global commodities market, like the UK would outbid for certain types of food, so like it gets higher now. Then Jamaicans have to pay a little bit higher because commodities markets change. But yeah, the struggle to get some decent food up there. It's a stress. Mangoes taste terrible in the UK.
No, the only mangoes that I will eat in the UK, no, are the ones that come from Pakistan or India, because those are the good ones.
Yeah, even they're not always good though.
No, but when I was like in school, I remember I was in like 8 or 9, so I was like, what, like 12 to 14? And my friend was like, oh yeah, mangoes are red or green. And I was like, no, they're orange. And I was like, she was like, no, they're red or green. And I'm like, are you dumb? Mangoes are orange. And she would not believe me. And till that point, I had never seen a British mango. Because my parents are not buying British mangoes. They know where to get the good mangoes from.
I don't know if they can grow mangoes here.
No, whatever they use.
Okay.
Like, whatever they sell as mangoes in, like, Waitrose and stuff.
Yeah.
Is what I'm talking about by British. I do not think they grow mangoes here.
Yeah, I was just confused.
But if you go to, like, a Waitrose or, like even the mango, like, cut mangoes that you eat here, you know they're shit.
Yeah.
But I was shocked when I realized that these people, like, British people did not know mangoes are orange. Like, you guys agree with me, right? Like, unwrapped mangoes are green, right? Mangoes are orange.
They're yellow.
Yeah, yellow. Orange. But she was like, red and green. I was like, no.
Green is like, you let that stay. Yeah. It's not ready.
From that, I saw one of these mangoes.
Or you cut it up and then you add spice on it.
Exactly. But that was like I was sheltered from that part of British culture for a long time, and I'm glad.
I'm glad too.
I mean, they invaded us for a reason, you know, like, and they still didn't get the right fruits back. No. Like, it's a pretty...
They have no fruit reference here. I've seen someone, like, drink coconut water from a coconut, and they didn't cut it open to get the jelly outside. They just threw away the coconut. I'm like, what's wrong with you? Don't you see the whole prize is inside? And she just left it there. And I'm like, y'all...
Did you take the jelly?
No, I didn't, because I have self-respect sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. But it hurt my heart because they really don't know better. A lot of persons, and not necessarily like one ethnic group in the UK, just a lot of people who grew up in the UK just don't have the exposure to nicer things in terms of especially fresher fruit. Mm-hmm. The passion fruits, people have told me they've never had a guava in their life. I'm like, what's wrong with you? It's there. It's amazing. But they just never had access to it regularly, or it's just not ripe enough and it looks kind of funny. So it breaks my heart, but also very proud to be from the tropics now.
Yeah, it like food links so strongly to cultural identity as well. Mm. Like we've been just talking about foods, but it actually links back, right? And I think when I first left the country for a long period of time, when I got back on the plane, I was like, yeah, I miss my family. I miss my friends. I miss my room. I miss the sun. But what I miss most is the food. I did not eat my meal on the airplane because I'm like, I'm not eating this shit when I'm 4 hours away from nice food. I refused. I was like, maybe I'll take yogurt. That's it. And then I landed. And I landed at 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. And I went to the morning restaurants. Mm-hmm. They open at 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. So straight from the airport, went outside, sat there and waited for them to open. I ate and then I went to sleep. I was like, oh, food. Like, of all the things I missed, maybe family comes close. Family and friends, they're like top, but I think food was on top for me, man. Food was on top, but yeah.
What was in this first meal? I want to know.
It was idli. It was idli and chutney. So idli is basically like a rice cake.
It's made of rice. And yeah. It's like a cake.
It's so delicious.
Like
it's
a spicy. Steamed rice
cake. Yeah.
Type of thing.
And it's healthy as well. It's healthy and tasty, which is hard. So,
not hard for us. I figure like a lot of our foods, like they have more healthy and it's also pretty tasty because they had to just make the most of like fresh foods around it. It's them here that don't know how to match the healthy and taste good. It's a struggle, man. It's a struggle.
They're just like, let me just add my greens on the side that don't taste nice. They've maybe got salt in them.
Maybe.
But, maybe.
So here's the thing. I think there's a gender angle in here as well. Mm-hmm. And an industrial revolution angle in here. So basically, if I went two generations back, my grandmother would have to cook all the food in the house. But she also didn't have a job. I mean, homemaker is a full-time job. Yeah. But I have to do the cooking and do an office job, right? Which is more. I mean, I don't have kids yet and she had kids. So I can't say I definitely work more than her because I can't make that comparison. But she had the time in the world. She got fresh food and she was able to make that food. She had to mash things herself. Mm. She didn't have a mixer, a grinder. Yeah. She had maybe a stove and she had to just figure it out, right? So when you have the least amount of machinery, you automatically get food that's raw. That's more raw, but also more fresh. Yeah. So your teeth need to chew more. Mm. It needs to go down your digestive system. Your body has to work harder to digest the food. And it's also more fresh. But when I come back home at 7:30 p.m. and I have a couple of things in the grocery store and I have to look at how expensive it is, then pick them up. I don't have the time to put 2 hours into making a meal every day like my grandmother would do. I will put things into a blender. I will put things into a microwave. I will get shit done and I will just eat it. Mm-hmm. Which automatically means that I'm having a way more unhealthier meal. Mm-hmm. And some of it is like feminism, liberation, having a job. Some of it is like not having access to fresh food. Some of it is just that mechanization. Mm-hmm. Like I can go to a store now, pick up a meal to microwave, eat it. My grandmother didn't have a choice. And I don't think she would have taken it if she did. Mm-hmm. She's probably ashamed of me if I do that, but I'm trying to hide it.
So we learn about this in school. It's in the 1920s. You've got like the roaring 20s in America, right? And the whole women are flappers and free and liberal. And, you know, this whole thing is happening. And I remember learning at that point, a couple of the big things that enabled that to happen were the beginning of these catalogs and these buy now pay later sort of schemes where they can order things and pay for them over time, but also they have access, they don't have to go shopping and in person. And the other thing were the invention of things, vacuums and like other house cleaning devices that save time. And I just found the acronym really funny. They were called labor saving devices, so they were LSDs. So that's what something that gave women more time and more freedom. But there was a massive LSD gave them freedom. But there was a massive like rural-urban divide, so that was mainly in the cities, but it's describing like, you know, your grandmother didn't have a mixer grinder. She can't just, you know, make some idli with some butter that she bought in the supermarket. It's gonna be she like, grind it herself, cook it, let it rise, all of that. But keep it in mind, we are liberal, we are free, we have freedom because of the LSD.
Yeah, and our jobs.
Yeah, that too.
I think also a part of for me, it's mm-hmm. back home, especially because in the Caribbean, or at least in different places, mm-hmm. there's abundance based on a season, and mm. persons have more like backyard food. So I don't buy mangoes. I mm. came to the UK and that's where I have to buy mangoes. Mm. And I'm shocked at the price these people are spending. It's not real. Mm. But back home, so everyone has a mango tree, or at least every other person has a mm. mango tree. When mango season comes, your neighbor just knocks with like 2 dozen mangoes and says, please help me. There are too many mangoes. Take some. And then you just get mangoes for like a while. And then you also have like an excess on your tree. There's a lot more abundance in that mm. respect sometimes, because you can do recipes, try different things, because you just have that much excess mm-hmm. that I can't do here mm-hmm. now that I've come to a place where every single item is at a high premium mm-hmm. cost because of whatever means of importing. So I find it also kind of difficult to sometimes wrap my head around being in a new food ecosystem versus a more communal food ecosystem back home. I'm still struggling with that now. I'm not used to buying one singular garlic bulb. It is mad that I go into Sainsbury's and they're just selling me one. I'm like, I need 6. Where are you going with one? And I'm not going to pay 50p for one. You better give me 6 for the price of one. I'm struggling.
I saw this on TikTok. We love TikTok. Basically, if you just use the green parts and you cut it down to like the root, you need the root and like a decent amount. Mm. And you just put it in water and it regrows. And now I just, like in the corner of by the sink, there's just like a thing of like whole spring onions.
Oh, and they keep on dying for me.
The spring, just spring onions.
Yeah.
You have to change the water.
I tried. This is why I have a pet rock. Big up, Rocky. Living things and me, sometimes it doesn't work.
Me neither, but this one I could grow. I don't trust myself to grow anything else.
I'll try it again. I'll see.
You need enough white part that it sticks out the water. I realize if they're completely submerged, they just drown.
That is true. They need to breathe.
Yeah. They need a little bit that pops out. And then you're good.
That's all.
That could work in a different context as well. But
yeah, adjusting to city life and food independence. What would that be called? Food autonomy? Resilience?
Whatever it is, I don't like it.
It's a struggle, man. It's a struggle.
Yeah, I think if I was a man, I'd be a sexist. Like, it makes sense, right? Like, imagine I come home from my job. Someone's cleaned the house. Someone has fresh hot food waiting for me. They're looking at me with a smile on their face. I don't come back to a dirty room and like some random shit to eat and just going into the bed and watching Netflix. Like, which sounds like a better option? So sexism makes sense. It's bad, but it makes sense if you're a man.
So you want to be a man in the 50s with a wife?
By 50s, do you mean 1950s and my 50s?
1950s. American 1950s. American yeah, housewife.
I think I would be a great American 1950s man. Man, you don't have inequality. You all are strong. I have a wife who listens to everything I need. She just takes care of everything.
You can buy a house.
I can buy a house. After I can buy multiple cars. Yeah. The house is only 5 times, maybe 6 times the yearly salary. Like,
you can pay it off in a year or two.
You can just buy it outright.
That's true. They had a catalog for that too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's who I want to be. A wife. American man in the 1950s. If there's a time traveler out there, please, whatever power you have to take me back and mess with time and bodies and everything, please, that's my soul. That and being a landlord in London.
Have you seen that like on TikTok, the rise in like housewives?
Traditional housewives.
Yeah, like I've seen it, especially one particular, I won't name her, but that one particular housewife that she's currently pregnant, I think with the third.
Okay.
Child. And like, she's just making everything from scratch and she just makes it look so aesthetically pleasing. Like, now I feel like I aspire to do that. Yeah. I need to make my own cornflakes from scratch.
You need to make your own water, man. Like,
she's going to be making water soon. I subscribe so I can see, because she's going to fathom something out of thin air. I know it. She's going to put up an evaporator somewhere and say, this is how I collect my own rainwater and distill it.
I thought technology wasn't there for traditional houses.
It's there. Once she had that KitchenAid stand mixer, I swear everything can happen after that. Everything happens. But it's also so glorified and just like, is this the easy life that I was robbed of because of women's suffrage? But then it's also a very curated, manicured presentation to TikTok, not showing everything else that goes on.
So the way I look at it, I think it's a bit of a gamble, because if you, like, before there was feminism, like, you had some element of choice based on who you married, but not everything, right? There was a lot of societal pressure, and also, in general, like, everybody, men, women, the first few days or weeks where you present yourself, you're the most polished. In the romantic context, professional context, you are the most polished. You're not who you really are. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I would definitely, if some like very handsome person came and they were like, I'm intellectual, I'm smart, I love you, I'd be like, yeah, man, sure, let's do it. And then later I figure out he's a gambler, he's a cheater, he's giving me AIDS and I'm pregnant. I don't want that. I don't want to gamble on that. Okay. Yeah, so anyway, I think that like before it was based, it's a gamble, right? Who you marry equals how much social protection you have, mm-hmm. how much economic protection you have, and how you're treated. So you could be a trad wife in a big house with like a lot of love, a lot of kitchen equipment, a lot of money to buy if you don't really make bread. Or you could be stuck in a one-bedroom flat having like two Maggie noodles because you can't afford anything else. Mm. So I think that like before, it's a gamble, right?
Yeah, you're not sure.
You're not sure.
What you get.
And now you are betting on yourself at the end of the day. If you're a woman with a job, you're betting on yourself. So I would rather bet on myself.
I agree with that. I remember, I think it was when I was 14, my mom wasn't home, I'd cooked or something. I just cleaned the kitchen really well. I had such a like strong sense of satisfaction. I was like, damn, I could be a housewife. And even at the age of 14, I had studied too hard and put too much effort into this. Like at this point in my life, I've done a degree, I have a job. Why have I spent all these years doing this? If I could just be a housewife, it's a waste of my time. Therefore, I've done too much for myself. And I'm
like, well, if I win a lottery, I also have 2 degrees and I also have a job. But if I win the lottery, I might not go to work. And I might be a stay-at-home... I'd ideally prefer to be a stay-at-home daughter than a stay-at-home wife.
That'd be nice. But
see, that's the thing. If you win the lottery, you're doing it for yourself. That's independence right there. It counts. Yeah. I don't want to depend on someone else and be like, why do I work so hard in my life? If I'm just going to be like, oh yeah, I'll depend on the man. No,
I'll take from him, but I won't depend on him. Like, sharing is caring, but not that much sharing. Yeah. I can take yours, that's fine.
Up to the level of sharing is caring, and then after that, sharing is caring, so...
Yeah, that's how it is, no?
I think I had a conversation with my mum recently, where their relationship between my parents is more traditional, where my dad takes care of the finances and stuff, and my mum works, but, like, she doesn't have to worry about, like, how the taxes work and how the bills work. She just, like, has her money. My dad looks after the house and all of that, and I was telling her, even if I get married, I wouldn't let my husband do all those things, partly because I'm too independent. I've been raised in such a way where I've been taught to look after my finances myself. I couldn't let that go to a man, but it would be so nice to have someone look after it for me. I can't let that happen.
That's why there's AI.
I don't trust it.
He's been making some real goof-ups in the past few days.
Yeah.
Maybe in a couple years, but like right now, I'm just like, I wish I could give it to a man, but I can't let myself give it to a man to do. Independence is too strong.
I like my independence.
Yeah.
It works for me.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if it was like way back in the day, like say 1850, I'd want to be a nun.
A nun where?
Ooh, I haven't chosen the location yet.
So different nuns have different levels of like freedom and devotions to the church. So there's this whole village in Belgium. I mean, it doesn't exist anymore, but it's a village where there were like all of these nuns and they just had theology learning. And
that's the type of nun I want to be, because one, I don't have to, you know, risk my health on carrying a child and giving birth, because that's dangerous in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry about STDs because, no. And two, I get meals in a building. That's what a lot of people are missing out of back in those days. Meals and a building and clothes and reading things. Yeah, well, I'd take the nun life, man. That's a longer lifespan. I could work with that. I wasn't going to be a peasant wife. Nope.
Yeah. So maybe that's why I feel I have my own cultural identity, but I'm not going to say, oh, I'm in the same place as all the women before me, because I'm clearly not. But I think there are small things that remain the same. I'd like to think so. So maybe I'm not eating fresh mango, but I'm eating some mango, even if it's in a poke bowl. I may not be having coconut on my hair, like dark coconut or whatever they used to use, but I am having a synthetic chemical shampoo that has coconut.
Vita Coco.
And I love the food. I love some of the culture, not all of it, not gonna lie. But like, nobody loves everything about their culture, everything about their religion. Nobody. Mm. I mean, nobody that I know. I'll be more clear. So I think we do tend to carry on maybe we live somewhere else, maybe we eat different food, maybe we have different levels of autonomy and in general Korea, but I think we link back to our cultures in a special way and we get to decide that. That is my concluding sentence, and I'm going to ask both of you to add anything else that you'd like to.
I think culture is like time and place too, so yeah, I'm a Jamaican, but I'm also a Jamaican born in the 90s that grew up with the internet, and I had access to different things as well. So there's culture that you identify with, but there's also a layer of what you're exposed to based on your age group as well. And I think that resonates across cultures too, like me resonating with another 20 something from a different part of the world. There's some cultural similarities that only people in our generational group get.
So my space.
I don't even understand high five. Never did that. That's a generation before me. I can't relate.
Yeah, I was not a MySpace kid.
Yeah. So like you can use your own base culture, but you build upon that with technology and your experiences as well. So there's more intermingling.
Facebook,
WhatsApp.
I think for me, I would say you can be as connected with your culture as you want to be. It doesn't matter what other people who perhaps share aspects or from the same background as you. Just because they do certain things or don't do certain things doesn't make them less or more British or any other thing. Your culture is what you find for yourself. And you shouldn't ever let anyone make you feel like, oh, I'm not as cultured as them.
Yeah. I'm going to tell a small story that my mother passed on, which her mother passed on. So, haha. Culture. Okay. But it was basically about this old wise man, and he used to perform a religious ritual in the morning. And what he'd do is there was a cat that kept disturbing him. So he kept a bowl of milk outside so the cat wouldn't come in and it would just drink the milk. And nobody understood why the milk was there. So they thought it was part of the ritual. So his son after him conducted the same religious ritual like his dad did. But he kept the milk, although the cat was like dead. And after that, they kept milk for like generations. And they didn't understand. The OG band did it to keep the cat away. But they just continued it despite there being no cat and for no reason and just wasted milk. So I think there's some element of following, not just blindly following with respect, but understanding what and why and integrating that as part of your culture. Because I feel like with religion and culture, like there are horrible things that come from all countries in the world, irrespective of what color you are. You just come from religion or culture. So I think there's an element of choosing, but also understanding why you're choosing that, then picking it up and carrying it along. Anyway, that helps us come to the end of our episode for today. If you have any ideas on how to express yourself and your culture in a line, two lines, say it on our Instagram or comment on our Spotify. Like, subscribe, and send this to somebody else who you think is more cultured or less cultured than you are. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.